Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 67. I don't know if you've noticed this, if you've been listening, but these numbers keep going up one by one every week because we have a new show every Sunday morning. And my name is David Brook, and I'm here with my co-host with the mostest, Forrest Hollingsworth.
Hello, my name is Forrest with two R's. And Dave, I gotta tell you, I'm feeling pretty super today.
Ooh, do you feel like an all-star?
I do. All that glitters is gold.
Oh yes, I love that song. That was a huge song when I was in college.
That was
a big
song at the time and still is.
Hey now, we are going to be talking about All-Star Superman this week in our new AIPT book club segment, thanks to the fact that there are no new comics coming out last week or next week, probably. So in our book club, first we're going to be talking about the news, but in our book club, we'll be talking about Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely's 12-issue All-Star Superman run. We'll be talking about what the story is about, what works, what doesn't work for us, best artistic and narrative moments, and then where are we going to go from here? Mm-hmm. And we actually have some answers because, you know, this actually came out in 2006, and some things have come out since, but maybe there could be a sequel someday. We'll get into that.
And we are going to try to avoid the spoilers for the end of the series. I know that last week we kind of talked about Venom all the way up to when it was currently releasing, and we should have done some spoiler warnings for that, I think. We're not going to spoil what happens at the end of All-Star Superman, but we are definitely going to talk about all the issues up to then, and the content up to then. Just as it's a much more older comic than Venom. Yeah. But this is a warning.
And it's also not ongoing, so it's definitively over, at least these 12 issues. Before we get there, though, we're going to be recapping the news, the latest and greatest comic book news to keep you up to date and connected. To start, Diamond to resume paying publishers after last week saying that they would stop paying vendors. but they'll be paying them with partial payments and deferrals. So I have imagined they told all these people, you're not going to get the money you're owed. And someone was like, okay, well, we'll sue you.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking and alluding to last week when we talked. Is like, Diamond can't possibly be in control of this entire process, right? Like, it's crazy to me that Marvel and DC and everyone's just kind of bending the knee to them. There has to be a much more significant legal portion to that, which would explain this letter.
Right.
That was released by Diamond, and this, in particular, founder and chairman and CEO, Steve Geppi of Geppi Family Enterprises. This guy's a real dork. Working with what we know today, below is an outline of vendor payments from Diamond Comic Distributors and Diamond Book Distributors. Beginning this week, the week of April 6th, vendors would receive 25% of the weekly amount due under your contract terms, which alludes to an obvious contract. Each subsequent week, you'll receive a 25% payment of that week's balance due. This reduced payment schedule will continue for 6 weeks, with the remaining 75% due in each of those weeks being deferred. Following that 6-week period, we'll begin payment of the deferred balance in equal payments over a 13-week period. Now, one of my friends on Twitter, who did a deep dive into Steve Geppi, the founder of Diamond's Twitter, and found his personal account, and found that Steve doesn't want to pay these vendors, but he sure is happy to offer to fly any woman that he thinks is attractive out to a hotel just to hang out for the weekend. Drinks, pools, candies, foods, whatever you want. You're so pretty and beautiful. Please, I have the monies.
Are you reading a tweet right
I'm
now?
I'm not, but it's pretty close.
Oh.
It's okay, pretty close to what this dude is doing. Gross. Obviously. Obviously gross.
According to the Newsarama news, he is taking a 50% salary cut. But at the same time, like, it's kind of weird that it's only 25%. They must have come to terms with these publishers. It sounds like they made a deal, and that's what this press release was about. It is interesting to me that it's 6 weeks. So that means they plan to not be shipping comics for at least 6 more weeks, right?
Because the assumption would be that they're getting more capital in 6 weeks somehow.
Right.
So they must be setting a date on when they anticipate being able to ship. So,
because then they say 13 weeks after the six, they will start to pay people equal payments. So 6 weeks, severely reduced payments, then 13 weeks to recover. That's a lot of weeks to get back to normal.
Yeah. And I think it is going to be a very long time before we're back to normal with regards to all this stuff.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I'm hoping that I know DC, I think, is still planning to release all their titles digitally starting at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel will likely follow in step because they kind of do as DC does and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my guess. As far as other publishers, though, a lot of them, if it is going to be 6 more weeks, they might have to delay even further. But maybe we'll be back to normal, some form of normal by June. I don't know. But based on this,
I think we're going to have something in place by June. I don't think we're going to be back to normal by any standard, any stretch of the imagination. I mean,
and
current
humanoids
estimates put this at 12 to 18 months,
right?
Which explains this next piece of news.
Yeah, so humanoids, to extend from that news just there, they are shifting all their titles to September and into fall that were supposed to be coming out over the summer. Mark Waid wrote a letter that was sent to all press that basically explains they are going to double down and work on more titles, sort of similar to what Bad Idea said, and to not worry, they're not going to be going anywhere anytime soon. Likely all these books that are shifting dates are already done and probably been done for a while, because Humanoids doesn't typically put out a lot of books, and they do put out graphic novels a lot of the time too. So they actually, if you go to aptcomics.com, they have a full list of all the titles that were the original date and then the new date. Some of them are actually reprints, like the Inkle softcover.
With new material,
yeah.
By the way, I know we talked about that previously, but that was the biggest piece of news out of this entire thing to me. This is kind of what all the publishers are doing. But I looked at that again, and I was like, they're still doing that.
Like, yeah, they're putting out another Meta Barons. Like, how many versions of Meta Barons are out there?
Talking about things that need to go through a focus group.
Mm. There's other stuff, too, that's new, like Omni. But, yeah, it's interesting that they shifted everything a few months, whereas a lot of other publishers are like, well, we're kind of playing it by ear each week.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel PR literally emails me on Tuesday afternoon and goes, no comics.
Right, yeah, and I think they posted that announcement on their social media the day before, Monday.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So they're definitely playing it like to the last second.
Yeah.
Likely someone's sitting there going, we can release them digitally. Guys, we can release them digitally. And someone's like, no, don't do it. Wait, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Tell me, ask me next week.
We're not going to touch on that article written by one of the publisher partners over at Comics Beat very much. I didn't put that news in here because it was all kind of hearsay. If folks know what we're talking about, where a creator or publisher, I can't remember which, was basically talking about all the ways that they could save the comics industry.
Yeah.
And one of them was like, delay digital releases. And it's crazy to me, and it was also crazy to everyone else in the comics industry on Twitter, that their solution to this problem was just don't release comics.
Yeah.
It's not, yeah. Sustainable.
The reliance on brick and mortar has always been a problem, and it's only exasperated now, right? I don't know how you move forward without making huge changes or shift something. I don't know.
Yeah.
There was also a New York Times article that got a lot of folks worried that came out on Thursday or Friday, and it was titled "Can Comic Books Survive the Coronavirus Era?" A lot of the information in it was news that we've talked about on the show, and any comic book fanatic like us would know about. But it also doesn't kind of get into the positive things that have come out, like creators trying to help comic book stores, Vault giving 50% of all their sales to comic book stores, stuff like that.
Yeah, and it doesn't really get into the resiliency of comics. Like, comics survived, like, World War II, when literally everything else stopped production.
Right.
Great Depressions, recessions, all that stuff. And so, comics industry folks, I retweeted in particular Zach Thompson, who said, as usual, rumors of comics demise is greatly exaggerated.
Right.
Anyone that's plugged into the industry knows that it's far more resilient than that.
I think from the outside looking in, especially for a reporter who may or may not know the industry as tightly as we do, might assume like, oh, it's just for kids. So,
and also I think that a reporter is looking at a, you've got a week-to-week industry, and you're not going to do it for this X number of weeks, you're done. Right? But comics don't really work in that way, because they kind of have multiple schedules. Like, yes, the brick-and-mortar part is week-to-week, but things also then get released on DC Universe and Marvel Unlimited and Comixology, and then they come out in trades, and then they come out in anniversary trades or hardcover collections, or then they release the Inkle and Meta Barons again and again and again.
30 years later.
Right, right. And comics has a lot of different timelines going on. The loss...
In the stories, too.
Right. The loss of the week-to-week thing is bad for people that buy single issues, for you and me, because we've had to completely change our podcast. But there's millions of people out there that only read trades.
Yeah, I actually wrote an article on Tuesday. I discovered, I didn't realize it, and maybe it wasn't as commonly known, but Marvel's still releasing all their trades as scheduled digitally. And they released 6 or 7 trades last week, including X-Men Volume 1 by Jonathan Hickman.
Yeah, they really should be clearer about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not tapped into their Twitter so much, so maybe they tweeted about it, but it wasn't immediately obvious to me until I was digging into Comixology's release schedule. But yeah, so there's a lot to learn about the comics industry right now, and I think people are still feeling things out. Who also is feeling things out is Dan Didio, who was recently interviewed by Drink and Draw Social Club, and he was asked about his biggest regret. And so, first of all, I don't know if this is the first time he's spoken out since he was fired.
It's not, but it's pretty close. Yeah.
It's pretty close. He hasn't spoken too much, hasn't certainly spoken openly too much about the firing. This isn't about his firing from DC Comics, but it is about the New 52, which was a huge initiative by him. And he had some interesting thoughts about what went wrong with New 52, in particular, the second year of New 52.
Yeah.
He mentions in this interview that he spent 7 to 8 months with others, of course, planning New 52. It went without a hitch, well, you know, in some people's opinion. And then it sort of fell apart from there, which is kind of interesting.
I don't think that he's wrong in that New 52 was well received initially.
Yeah.
But then they had no highway to go. There was nothing in front of them. He says that he regrets not spending the same amount of energy on year two of New 52 as they did on year one. And so that makes, you said the good 6 to 8 months build, right? Makes me think that in that time, they really only developed the first year of New 52, which is not sustainable.
Right.
And then he says, by the time we get into the third year, we're just dusting things off and dropping them in. They're not making sense because they're slightly changed, but not really changed. Fans don't have a point of reference anymore. You feel the wheels coming off the cart. And I think that that's totally true. And I'm glad that he knows that and that he sees that. But I don't think he understands. Maybe he does. Maybe he doesn't. I don't want to speak to that. That's his fault.
Yeah.
Like, if you're not giving creatives the leeway, the space, and most definitely the time to figure out new angles on things, of course they're going to just drop a different painted version of that thing in. They have no other option.
Right. Right, and you're not, as an editor, you need to be following with these writers, because you could have a writer who just loves this idea, but it doesn't make sense in the grand scheme of things, right?
Right, right.
When I read that line you just read, not making sense because they're just slightly changed but not really changed, before this we started recording, I did a deep dive into Action Comics by Grant Morrison and how he got to reboot Superman or revamp. And one of the problems with that series is he's pulling from Silver and Golden Age ideas. So it almost doesn't feel new at all. It feels like he's just kind of doing a remix. And I don't think that was the point of New 52. I don't think it was like... Although, at the same time, though, of course, you know, Batman and Green Lantern, they got to keep a lot of their continuity as they moved into the New 52.
Right.
So
yeah. I mean, they were never going to upset their stable characters, right?
Right. But then you're like, wait, what is the identity of this new universe if some characters cannot change and others don't?
I mean,
don't?
He's very right that it's just a new coat of paint.
Yeah, exactly. When you read this, though, did you think about G, what is it?
G5?
What is it?
5G.
5G, sorry.
I don't,
because it made me think like, oh, maybe he learned his lesson. He was planning years of 5G
I doubt it.
Development.
I doubt it.
Yeah. Someday someone's going to do some deep dive interview with him about 5G and 52 and what happened. Yeah, it'll be fascinating.
It will be.
Something that's not fascinating, SDCC has announced they're going to let us know if they'll be canceling the biggest comic convention of the year. They haven't yet decided. There is an evaluating and any financial liability thing going on. So there's a lot of money to be made and to be lost here. And yeah. I'm sure this is coming down to insurance.
Yeah. I mean, the same with other events we've covered, GDC, Emerald City Comic Con, E3. Those concerns are paramount, especially to businesses that are set up solely to promote one event.
This news comes from Newsarama's Chris Arendt, and it actually came out of a tourism, the San Diego Union-Tribune, and talking to the Tourism Authority CEO, Joe Terzi. So maybe people don't know this so much, but when it comes to STCC, it is so entrenched in the local politics because it's so important to the local economy.
Yeah.
I don't think the con can just pull out, like, because they're making the right decision. Like, literally, like, all the local politics and politicians are involved in this. Yeah. All of the tourism authority. Like, you're literally, you know, affecting millions of lives because of the effect it'll have on the economy.
Yeah. But the flip side of that is that you're affecting millions of lives by hosting the event.
Yeah.
And endangering those lives. In a much more immediate and tangible way than the financial aspects, maybe, right? With illness.
Yeah.
And also, that venue right now is a homeless shelter, an emergency homeless shelter. So,
is it really?
Yes.
I didn't know
that. So I don't think that SDCC happens this year in any way, shape, or form as planned. Whether that means a postponement, I don't know. Or whether that just means they're going to pivot to next year. I don't know.
There's not enough time really to pull it off, but if they could do some kind of online convention, somehow still make some revenue by charging folks some kind of, but you'd need incredible infrastructure in a virtual world, like a virtual convention space that I don't think they could pull off in three months.
I mean, Emerald City just launched a month later a virtual store. And they're selling all of the like branded Emerald City merch. It's actually really nice. I know SDCC has their own merch as well. And then they're also doing like a virtual artist alley. I don't know if Emerald City is getting a cut of the proceeds that go towards those artists, if they go through their links or their storefront or whatever, or if they're just linking to the artist pages. But there's definitely room to do something like that.
Yeah, for sure.
But I don't think SDCC is happening.
Yeah, I haven't canceled my flight or hotel yet, but I guess I should wait anyway because you have to like wait for the flight to be like, oh, now you can cancel because it's still bad out there.
Right, yeah.
I mean, you know, talking about virtually, Kevin Eastman is hosting an online hangout to celebrate TMNT, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number one's anniversary. It's been 36 years since they got the books from the printer, he says on his website. He's done a couple of these Facebook Hangouts, or is it a Facebook Hangout or Facebook Live?
Facebook called. Live, Google Hangout, yeah.
It's pretty cool. I keep seeing, you know, different publishers pushing their creators out in virtual ways rather than, you know, not having anyone out there to kind of be a face of the company. So I'm glad to see Eastman pulling something like this off. Fans, especially of that specific title are gonna love it, but I don't know, it's a crazy time where I think any creator can just jump on a Zoom, right, and just have a call with people.
Yeah absolutely. I mean, I think John Krasinski has been hosting that Some Good News network.
Yeah,
they had like Steve Carell and stuff on, so I think that it's a weird time. Mm-hmm. We're all in it together for sure.
Yep.
I think that this is much better, and John Krasinski's thing is much better than the celebrities that are getting absolutely buck wild because their publicists aren't around.
What do you mean?
Oh, there's been a bunch of...
Oh, you mean like the song where they sing?
Well, that, and then also celebrities being like, I mean, some people have to die, yeah. Like Instagram Live and stuff. Something that would never get past their publishers.
Oh, I think I know the one you mean.
It was Vanessa Hudgens. I don't want to say the wrong name, but I'm pretty sure.
It was.
Yeah.
It was, yeah. Well, you know, we can all band together for the Ringo Awards, which are now taking nominations. You can go to their website. You enter your name. Anyone can go in and nominate the best cartoonist, best writer, best inker of the year, best artist, et cetera, best letterer. And this will determine who the winners are at the Ringo Awards, which I believe are at, hold please. Do you know what convention they're at?
I don't know what convention they're at.
Baltimore Comic Con.
Baltimore.
Indeed.
Saturday, which October 24th, currently.
Cool, cool. One of the bigger award shows of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You got winners like Fiona Staples, Black Hammer, Immortal Hulk, Tamara Bonvillain, Mad DC, those kinds of folks from last year. Brian K. Vaughan.
I would vote for All Star Superman. Because we're about to talk about it.
The write-in winner, a 12-year-old comic.
Somehow it wins every year for 30 years. Just like Inkle. In our next segment, AIPT Book Club, we're going to be talking about All-Star Superman. To start this segment, we're going to give you a little 401 on the series if you haven't heard about it. It came out in 2006, it started. It took 3 years to come out. And so the book starts... Can I just get right into it?
Yeah, go for it. I'm going to interject as necessary, but please take it away.
Okay, so it's about Superman.
Hey, now actually, you're an all-star. Superman.
No, stop. Stop him. Get a buzzer. No. The all-star... first of all-star in the All-Star Superman, it's actually a repeating series of series. Frank Miller actually did All-Star Batman at one point. Mm-hmm. Later on. But basically, it's a way, it's not in continuity necessarily. I mean, it can be if you want it to be, but for headcanon-wise.
It's one of the Elseworlds Black Label-esque things where they can reference anything that's happened in continuity, but also has no direct impact on the stories after it.
Right. It basically allows the creators to do and say whatever they want, put their stamp on the character. Yep. The book opens with a scientist named Leo Quintum, who is, well, it doesn't... That's not the first panel, but anyway, he's going into the sun doing some
first panel. Can we dissect that real quick?
Oh my god, this guy isn't gonna let me even explain the book. Go ahead.
The very first page is literally just like doomed planet, hopeful scientists, spaceship, nice family. Like it distills Superman down to that one page.
And then we see a double page splash of him like flying in this like bright sunlight. Mm-hmm. He is the hope, the hope of all.
That's very cool.
He is the everyman. So the entire book is kicked off with the scientist doing this science experiment in the sun, which was all a plan by Lex Luthor to basically send as many yellow sun rays into Superman and overpower him to the point where he is now dying. He's not dying quickly. It's slowly over the course of 12 issues. And... basically, it's Lex Luthor's final and a plan to get rid of Superman once and for all. But that's like the overarching plot. Mm-hmm. Each issue has its own plot of its own.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Lois Lane gets superpowers, or there's a Bizarro Superman narrative. There's a Jimmy Olsen episode, I would call it. And it all amounts to... Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely's attempt to tell the ultimate Superman story, to touch on every aspect of Superman that's interesting or fascinating or worth telling, while also wrapping it all into a very interesting sci-fi story. There are so many cool sci-fi elements to each story that kind of bend the mind, make you think in certain and different ways, and make you kind of see how anything can happen. Mm-hmm. And while this is happening, Lex Luthor is like the opposite of Superman. He only appears in a couple issues, but he is... So the depiction of Superman is important to point out, I think, in that he's so casual. He is so... he has so much confidence in his body. He has no ego whatsoever. He just is Superman. He saves the day because he is Superman.
He is Superman, yeah.
Meanwhile, Lex is like... a reflection of that, where he is constantly questioning himself. Is that true? He's constantly blaming Superman.
Explaining himself.
Yeah. he has vanity, he's constantly explaining, like, Superman, it's Superman's fault that I'm not this or that. And he's constantly developing new technologies as if to prove himself. And he's just, like, so inside his own head. And I think what's fascinating about this depiction of Lex Luthor is he thinks he's smarter than he really is. And we see that midway through the series, where he interacts with Clark Kent and makes multiple comments about how, you know, he could never be Superman, or he could be if he worked out. Meanwhile, he's standing right in front of him, right?
Right. I do think that that is supposed to be funny and on the nose in a sense, but also Morrison and quietly talked about how come Superman doesn't use some powers to, like, make himself look schlubbier or, like, wear big clothes, right, and stuff. And so there's a little bit of that happening too. They're kind of playing, right, with both sides of it and explaining away some things very quickly.
Right, because the glasses just don't cut it for them.
Right.
For the secret identity.
And so they give him these big, two sizes too big clothes. And actually, quietly, quite literally draws his face, like, less defined. His chin is much bigger.
Right.
And, like, mm-hmm, yeah.
Like, pudgier. Yeah. And yet he's still huge. That's the thing that's interesting about this version of Superman. He's quite thick.
Yes.
He looks almost like a bodybuilder.
There is a point later on where Superman is Clark, but then mm-hmm. has to go save them. And someone's right. like, damn, Clark, you could be Superman. Oh, yeah, oh, wait, you are Superman. I guess you took Clark away.
Was that the scene where they were, like, impressed with his ass?
Yeah, and then Olsen
and just, he's like, oh, thank you for noticing my, I've been doing the Stairmaster.
Jimmy Olsen just magically shows up with a Superman suit for him.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. That was interesting. All in all, I think the series is very much a final period on Superman, if you ever needed to know what he was all about.
Yeah, now, I think it works well as your first Superman story and your last Superman story.
I know that Grant Morrison has said, like, this is, like, the embodiment. He's folded every version he liked about the character into mm-hmm. it, and I'm not necessarily sure it's pulled off so well, in that I don't see, like, you know, Mark Waid Superman or John Byrne Superman necessarily in this character, but because he's so calm, you don't usually see Superman, like, this, like, casual about everything. Yeah. But it is pulled off in such a way that you really do get the sense of, like, this alien who comes to Earth, falls in love with it, wants to defend it, and is, like, a symbol for all of us to be better.
And the central structure to that, or the reason that it is distilled so strongly, is that he's dying, right? So it's 12 issues. Morrison said that it's literally supposed to sync up to, like, the 12 months of the year. It's the last solar year of Superman's life. What does he do? Who is he?
Yeah.
Right. And it's actually structured very well around kind of the Odyssey, and especially the labors of Hercules. In one of the early issues, the time traveling Samson says, you're going to complete these 12 labors in your dying year. And Samson knows that that's going to happen because he's a time traveler. So
convenient.
It's like Superman is going to save life. He's going to brew creation, he's gonna create life, he's gonna just defeat evil, he's gonna save Earth, he's gonna return from the underverse as one of the named ones, and he's gonna conquer death, answer the unanswerable question, that kind of stuff. And there are actually 12 discrete things that happen over the course of the series too. They're tangible, and it's weird because Samson doesn't list the 12 things that are going to happen, only a handful of them.
Right.
But all 12 things do happen. In particularly, in one issue, multiple things are done.
Right.
So it has a very loose structure in that it's kind of started and bookended by Lex Luthor and Superman's confrontation with Lex Luthor. But those intermittent stories are actually tied to that overarching myth of Superman, right? It's very mythical.
And I thought it was smart of them to not put one of these things in each issue, because multiple get done in some issues.
Right, I think, like, 3 or 4 of them get done in issue 10.
Doesn't in issue 10, he's, like, contemplating, he doesn't even know what all 12 are? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, like, it's not like it's... Right. You know, it's not like in the first issue, Lex Luthor's like, you must complete 12 things.
Complete my trials.
You just did one, and there are 11 more, and then it goes to be continued.
And then in the in-betweens, right, the bits where the labors aren't as obvious, Morrison is playing around with the, and quietly too, is playing around with all the typical things that you know about Superman. Able to bound from building to building. What if Superman was evil? What if Lois had his powers?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. They distill all of those, primarily, I guess, Silver Age storylines.
Yeah.
Down into one issue or into one trial, essentially. And he touched on that in particular. Morrison did an interview with Newsarama about every issue. And I think as...
This is back in 2008.
Yeah. And I think as with any of Morrison's stuff, it's all in the manual. Like, you have to read Morrison's interviews sometimes for clarity's sake. It becomes easier the more you've read his work and the more you understand his creative process to not have to go and read all of his interviews. But he does write novels, basically, in interviews. And he said that he had read various accounts of Superman's creation and development as a brand. I read every Superman story and watched every Superman movie I could lay my hands on, from the Golden Age to the present day, from the socialist scrapper man Superman of the Depression years, through the super cop of the 40s, the mythic hyper dad of the 50s and 60s, the questioning liberal Superman of the early 70s, the bland superhero of the late 70s, the confident yuppie of the 80s, the overcompensating Chippendale Superman of the 90s, etc. I read takes on Superman by Mark Waid, Mark Millar, Jeff Johns, Denny O'Neill, Jeff Loeb, Alan Moore, Paul Dini, Alex Ross, Joe Casey, Steve Siegel, Garth Ennis, Jim Steranko, and many others. And I think so, as we're saying, you can see all of those elements. Some are a lot stronger than others. But it's all there and it's very intentional, down to the point that in one of the issues, he actually shoots little Superman out of his fingers. Which is one of the Superman Silver Age plots or powers that he had.
The series won a lot of awards, too.
It did, yeah. So part of the way through, they're slapping Eisner Award-winning stickers on it.
They were, yeah. It won the Eisner Award for Best New Series in 2006, Best Continuing Series in 2007 and 2009. It won Harvey Awards for Best Artist, Best Single Issue. It won an Eagle Award for Best Comic Cover and Best Comic Color. For good reason.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's probably one of the books you would hand anyone if they were to read, if they had never read comics, you would hand one of these to them out of the top five, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe is that fair?
Yeah.
Top five?
Yeah. I think that's fair.
So what works for you with All-Star Superman?
It's a distillation of the character. I don't care very much. I'm not one of those people that finds Superman boring. I know that that's a complaint that's leveled against him, like, oh, he has so many powers, he can't possibly go wrong and stuff like that. But I care about Clark a lot more than I care about Superman, I guess. And what this series does is it reconciles those two identities very well and distills it down to kind of the essential moments of that character. And through everyone has that myth that you're going to see your entire life before you the moment you're dying, right?
Uh-huh.
And this series is that, but Superman has the ability and the forethought to be able to do that before it happens. Mm-hmm. And what does he do with that, right? And I find that very interesting and very well done.
It's such an adventure, isn't it?
It is. And I like that there's a part later in the series where that's text. He's writing basically his will and testament, and he says, what a life I've had.
Right.
To be able to go to space, to save people's lives, to see multiple universes and peoples and aliens and all sorts of these things and stuff. I just really, really like that. He's a goofy, romantic, idealized hero, and I don't think Morrison shies away from that. Mm-hmm. Superman... In small moments, I actually find him a little unlikable in this series. There's a particular one that we can get to. But for the most part, he's a very warm, confident, understanding person that embodies all of the best of the planet that he came from, as well as Earth. And and I don't think, like, Morrison is interested in dissecting that or taking it apart or making it pieces. It's just, here's Superman as a whole. He is us idealized. And it's not cynical at all. It works really well in the sense that they're setting up a dichotomy between Superman is someone that does, and Lex is someone that says.
Actions speak louder than
words.
Right,
and I think even in that, through that lens, Lex is someone that says very good things. I don't find him entirely detestable or unlikable or anything like that. Like, he says good things about humanity and industry and ingenuity and stuff. He just ends up on the wrong answer for those things, right? And I think that that's what makes him the perfect villain for Superman. I think Morrison does that, and their relationship throughout the series is really, really interesting. The art is also very good, though I do not care for the coloring so much. Quietly is very considered. I know some people don't like his art. I tend to like it. There are times when I don't, but I think it's really funny that he likes to draw people needing moisturizer just like so dearly. Cassandra Nova in New X-Men and Lex here in particular, their heads are like raisins. I really like it, actually.
Wrinkled.
And he's incredibly good at body language. There's a lot of momentum and fluidity to the scenes.
For sure, yeah. I've always loved Frank Quitely's work. Mm-hmm. I think I first read him with We Three. It was the first
one. I do love We Three, yeah.
Which I believe they just wrapped before the series started, right?
Yes. They were actually working on We3 when Morrison brought the idea to Frank, he said.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a person on Earth who would say this is a bad series.
I might say it's not for them. There are people that don't like it, for sure. But
oh, yeah? I wonder why. We'll get to what we don't like in a minute. But for me, the story works so well because of the casualness of Superman. He's just the embodiment of confidence and self-reliance, and he just knows he can pull everything off. Mm-hmm. And even when there is doubt and that someone, we all might die, he's like, it's all good. We'll just have to keep trying. And I think that's a lesson we can all take to heart. I mean, of course, there's the iconic scene where there's a girl who's going to jump off of a building, and he tells her, he enters the scene, almost every scene, he isn't like deeply happy or deeply sad. He's just kind of is.
Yeah.
And he goes and he actually holds her for a moment. And he says, you're stronger than you think you are.
Yeah.
And he's just so certain. And I think that's something that you don't normally see with every superhero. I mean, of course, Spider-Man's constantly doubting himself and he captures that so well, that humanity. Whereas Superman is not only the everyman, but he's the, like, an icon for what we can be. So it's like soothing to read this comic and get that tale.
Yeah, I know that. I don't think Morrison's interested in being cynical about it at all.
No, although he does end up being cynical in Action Comics, but we might get to that in a minute. Another thing that was really fascinating about this that worked for me was how he transcends this physicality and becomes this spiritual transcendent thing, which is a theme that Morrison does in a lot of his works, to take the superhuman and go beyond. What's the next layer? Mm-hmm. And I might be spoiling a little bit the ending, but it's kind of fascinating. It goes in that direction. Also, you know, the like you were saying, the identity of Clark is so very important to the character, and it's not lost here. So many Superman stories, they end up just focusing on the cosmic hero who battles giant monsters. Right. Which actually Chris Copeland talked about in his Cliched article this week, how there's always a giant lizard for superheroes to fight. But here we get this version of Clark, which is he wears baggy clothes. He's clumsy. He's pulling off this character. And yet he's also Clark. And meanwhile, Lois is contemplating how she is deeply in love with Superman, but not necessarily Clark. How does she reconcile those two things?
Yeah, I do think that's very interesting. And it's something that is more subtext than it is literal text in the series, and that's actually one of the complaints I've seen levied against the series, people being like, well, how come when he tells her she doesn't want to accept that he's also Clark, Like, she ignores it, or she's like, oh, you're pulling a trick on me and all this stuff. And it's because as much as he knows, she knows that the person that she needs isn't Clark, it's Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And he also knows that. That's why when he's writing his will and testament, he doesn't say, oh, and by the way, I'm Clark Kent. And right. he doesn't, you know, sign it Clark Kent of Earth or anything like that, which I've seen takes on in other series. He knows that what the world needs is Superman. And he embodies that for people, even when he does doubt himself. Mm-hmm. And gives them, trusts himself to be able to give them the tools to take that and to become their own Superman, the everyman, like you were saying.
Right, right.
And right. that scene where the girl is on the rooftop is a very good distillation of that, because, like you said, he's literally saying, you are stronger than you think you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important.
He's also I think one reason why a lot of people don't necessarily like Superman more than Batman, I'm going to compare the two. Batman is like this like idealism, this like dream for a teenager or a 20 something person who's like, he's a billionaire, right? Mm-hmm. You could just see yourself with all these gadgets. It's so cool.
Billionaire, Superman, playboy.
And I think this is actually mentioned in that interview we're mentioning
it is,
earlier. Yeah. Morrison talks about how Superman still has a boss at the Daily Planet. You know, he still has to go put in his 9-to-5. He actually has to file his, you know, his articles on time, even while saving the planet three times over. Mm-hmm. And that's like a fascinating element that isn't lost in this series. Moving on to art. Obviously, I'm a huge Frank Quitely fan too. I love how he blocks scenes, the way he frames scenes, and the layout of this book is so structured. It feels so solid, and that blends well with Superman's confidence. And I think you feel that in the structure of the panels. Also, Quitely is so good at adding a bit of energy to any scene. Mm-hmm. And you see that with his costuming. His clothes are always like ruffled and there's detailing in there. You feel the energy of that. It's not stiff. And there's two scenes I want to call out. One, when it comes to kinetic energy, there's a scene where Lois has her super suit. Superman flies up in the air really, really fast. And her hair in the next panel is now floating up in the air because all of that pressure and air just drew her hair up into the air. But you wouldn't immediately notice like what happened. So your brain actually has to connect the dots and go, oh, Superman's moving so quickly out of panel, the last panel, it's moved her hair. And it's just like little details like that. And then another scene with the girl on the rooftop. When we see her, the first shot is her dropping her phone, and the phone is like a couple inches out of her hand, already falling. That just adds this tension that wouldn't have been there if she was still holding the phone or if the phone was gone. That Superman is literally getting there to the last second before she may jump. And that just adds this extra space in between scenes for you to like fill in. Mm. It's really, really well done. But nothing is perfect. Was there anything that didn't work for you in this book?
It's very, very limited. I don't like the coloring very much. Mm-hmm. I think it's very flat. I don't think that it highlights the best of Quietly's art very much. It certainly doesn't detail how much motion and fluidity and detail and stuff like that there is in the scenes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then also there's a particular issue where we're talking about kind of the idealized Superman, right? And everything that he does is heroic and compassionate and understanding, except for one scene where he's building a rocket out of Bizarro World.
Trash.
Yes. He's having the Bizarros build a rocket. And one, I like what they're going for in that issue, but the dialogue is near incomprehensible. Because it's all reverse Bizarro talk. I like that they reference that even in the issue when there's a smart Bizarro named Zabarro who says, it pains me to see you talking this way. But that character, Zabarro, wants to leave Bizarro World with Superman. And he's like, you know, we have these plans for the rocket, but I've noticed it only includes one person. I have plans that make it so that two people can come. And Superman just kind of rejects that. And it's like, I'll see you again someday. And I found that very unsupermanly.
I like that, it. Like the phrasing.
You know what I mean? In that, like, Zabarro's like, hey, I really want to get out of here. And also, I know how to get out of here. And Superman is like, nah. It just didn't fit the character. And it especially didn't fit this depiction of the character. There's something...
Well, he does say, you know, you need to stay here because you are the best of them. And look, you're already helping them and you're, change.
You're an example of how Bizarro World is getting smarter. And stuff like that. Yeah. And that's all good. But it just felt weird and uncharacteristic to me, I guess.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, he's, I mean, I guess that you couldn't have two people on that rocket. It was made out of trash, after all.
Right. Yeah.
And Superman was going to die. I don't know why. Was it the pressure?
It was the gravity. Well, it's two things. Yeah, yeah. It's the gravity, and it's also the red sun.
Moving on to me?
Yeah, you.
I had two issues with the book. Two issues. Two problems. One was issue number 3 with Atlas and Samson. Yeah. I mentioned earlier how I loved how he was so casual the whole book, and he's very casual in this issue as these two men try to show Lois they're stronger than Superman, you know, with a dick swinging contest, essentially. And he is calm. Superman remains calm for much of the issue, but there is a certain point where he's like, that's it, I've had enough. Now, I know it's because Lois almost got killed or taken out of reality. I thought that was a little... I feel like... Yeah, exactly. The whole series, he's always finding creative ways to find a solution. It's never just to punch something in the face, although he does with the sun in the end, or in the 11th issue. But in this issue, he doesn't even try to figure out how to get around these guys. He just kind of goes with it.
Yeah.
And it just ruins his day.
It
and
does.
And I want to use a quote from Grant Morrison himself from the Newsarama interview. He said, for this issue, I wanted to see Superman doing tough guy shit again, like he did in the early days, and then again in the 70s, when he was written as a supremely cocky macho bastard for a while.
True.
I thought a little bit of that would be an antidote to the slightly soppy Super Christ portrayal that was starting to gain ground.
I think that that's all viable.
It just doesn't jive with the rest of the series to me. And that's why it threw me off. I didn't dislike the issue necessarily.
Sure,
like, I didn't, like,
yeah, I think
hate it
is the weakest issue for me, too. But I do like the idea that, like, Superman's a little like, oh, well, Lois is having fun. So whatever.
Right. You know? That's true. She does, and she has a good reason to put him through it because he's been lying to her for years.
Right.
To go along with that, I was a little surprised by the, like, the penis size, penis virility stuff that's in the series. I know, I guess Morrison was going for it's definitely a book about a man, and we see that with, obviously, the focus of Superman, but also, like, the father stuff in the series.
Yeah.
Lois is obviously not as predominant as she could have been. I was just a little surprised, like, there's a scene in issue 7, where Superman realizes Lombard takes Viagra, and that's why he wasn't bizarroed.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
And there's a scene with, like, Atlas and Samson where he's like, my belt buckle's bigger, and she was looking at my belt buckle, and you know what they mean there. Yeah. And then there's another scene with a Daily Planet worker and she's looking out the window, and there's a window washer, and she makes a comment that's basically like, oh, I know he has a big penis. I just, again, like, the book is so wholesome.
Mm.
These things just threw me off. Yeah. I was like, I don't know why they're there.
I guess my take on it is that Morrison is just trying to depict the mundanity of normal life. Like, yeah, people say stuff like that. Masculinity is powerful, but also toxic.
Yeah.
And sometimes that toxicity is essential, I guess.
Right.
I agree that it doesn't jive with the ethos of the story.
I had one other problem. There is a Jennifer Lopez reference in issue 2.
I thought that was so funny.
it's just, I mean, you know, fascinatingly, it still kind of holds up because J-Lo is still in our society and doing stuff. But it does date it a little bit.
Did you think so? I mean, I think that's
the
point, though. Because it's a Superman
from the far
future saying, who was J-Lo?
Right, and somehow he's got this information, but doesn't know, like, probably who the president
anything
was.
Anything else, right, yeah. So I thought that was, to get a little cheesy for a second, you can read a lot into Morrison, any of his series, but I do think that he was trying to be funny about the timelessness of art.
Well, that's true, because J-Lo is an artist.
Right.
Yeah. Speaking of art, what was your favorite artistic moment?
They're in the 10th issue. The 10th issue is focused around two surviving Kryptonians coming to Earth. Mm-hmm. And Superman is following them around. He doesn't really want to get in a discreet or explicit fight with them so much. So he's just kind of following them around, trying to reason with them. And then he says, like, how did you get all this stuff anyway? And they reference earlier in the series, he's developed like this 10 billion ton key to the Superman fortress. Awesome. So that he's the only person on Earth that can pick it up until there's someone else that needs to be able to pick it up, which is, again, a very idealized Superman-type mantle thing. But then, of course, these two Kryptonians take the key and misuse it. There's a robot butler right on the other side of the door, and one of the Kryptonians drops the key into the robot's arms, and it, like, tears the robot's arms off. Mm-hmm. And so quietly has drawn these two Kryptonian characters, their backs are so up straight, they're so tall, that you could, like, put a ruler against their back, walking forward proud into the fortress, while Clark Kent is bent down on his literal hands and knees, trying to help the robot in the foreground. And it's just a really great storytelling moment for the character. Quietly also is a master of body language. And that scene alone tells you everything that you need to know about Superman and his reconciliation between where he came from and where he grew up. So I like that scene a lot.
That whole issue is fascinating because he's like never afraid of them, even when they're like showing signs that they could probably like attack him.
Yeah.
Because they're such dicks.
Yeah, they're terrible.
Yeah, that was a good scene. There's so many sort of heartfelt moments like that in the series.
For sure.
This is a really good book to read during the pandemic.
Yeah, I did feel incredibly warm after reading it for a bit.
There's just so many, like, yeah, and it's just, you feel these positive, like, anything, we're going to get through this, because Superman says so.
and because Superman is you, I think it's an important part.
He's inside
of the story.
Us all.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. My favorite art in the book, there's a lot of great moments, but it's in issue number 7. It's the double page splash with Superman getting dragged to the Bizarro underworld.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And it's this giant cube planet.
Yeah. And all of the
rendered
continents. Yeah.
Yes, it's rendered with continents and water. It's like how our Earth would look, but somehow it's cubed. It makes no sense.
Well, and the continents and the water are reversed, too.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, you've got all these characters on the left, like, dragging him. And it's interesting. Like, he's not fighting too much because he's sort of taken off guard. Again, there's so much energy in, like, the way his cape is flowing, the way these characters are kind of, like, floating there. And yet you can tell they're sort of pushing him forward like an unstoppable juggernaut. Mm-hmm. It's a cool shot. It's one of the only double-page splashes in the whole series, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder why they went with a double page splash here, but not elsewhere.
I think that it's just a convenient storytelling moment to show how the extent of Bizarro World.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Mm-hmm.
What is your favorite narrative moment?
My favorite narrative moment comes near the end of the series. Superman, and by extension Clark Kent, is getting his entire estate in order. He writes a newspaper article called Superman Dead. And he, like, publishes it, or, like, he shows up with a laptop with the story written by Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And then we quick cut after that to Lois and Jimmy Olsen talking in the park, because Superman has actually disappeared for a time. And Jimmy says, like, hey, Lois, what are you doing out here? Like, he's basically saying, like, you need to get over it. We had the memorial for Clark and for Superman. There's nothing more that we can do, right? Mm-hmm. And Lois knows that, especially because she knows Superman has been dying. But she says, well, I know he's still out there. He's just fixing the sun and then he'll be back.
Right.
And I think that some people may find that moment like Lois just can't accept it. But that's not how it reads to me at all. It's like her saying the idea of Superman will be back. and we need to wait for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that moment a lot. Her faith in him, her hopefulness, and by extension in humanity, is it feels extra sensory. It just feels good and warm. I like it. There's nice. A bit in one of the interviews where Morrison says that he's really entertained by the idea of Superman being a tulpa, which is a kind of Tibetan metaphysical idea essential to Twin Peaks, too. Don't get me started on that. About the idea of a thought form that has independent existence beyond its creator and physicality. And there's these little moments peppered throughout the series where Superman creates life. He creates a planet or Earth Q. And they're literally showing the existence of Superman on that Earth simultaneously. Like Nietzsche writing and coming up with the idea of the Superman, the Ubermensch, the everyman.
Yeah.
And then later another one that is Siegel and Schuster, like drawing and writing Superman on that planet. And right, I just those little, they're funny, they're metatextual, they make sense. It's really well done.
There's so many moments that make you think in the mm-hmm. series.
Yeah. What about you?
Mine's not as thought-provoking. My favorite narrative moment was when he feeds the Sun Eater in issue number 2. Mm. I just love the sci-fi crazy idea of this giant black alien that one might see as a monster that should be killed, but Superman has it in his Fortress of Solitude, and he has to feed its suns by taking a special hammer and smashing a tiny star as big as a fist.
Yeah.
And then he just spreads it around like you'd feed a goldfish. Mm-hmm. Just the concept of that is so cool. And it does pay off later, because that character does play into the later parts of the series too. But mm-hmm. I don't know, this, the concept of that is just so cool to wrap your head around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the moment later where he's like, that one of the final issues where he's getting everything in order and he's like, guess it's time to let this horrible monster go.
Like, yeah, I know, right?
It's really funny.
And he's like, he's floating in space with it and he's like almost like saying goodbye
yeah,
to it.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, that thing could just kill an entire solar system. And quietly
totally
dude.
Draws the robot like, what the fuck are you doing?
Right, yeah. Right. It almost kind of conveys the fact that Superman is okay with like a Galactus style monster, right? That would kill millions of lives.
He's blind to the idea of good and evil and balance.
Yin and yang. Right.
Dualism.
So in our last part of this segment, we always end with where we think this is going. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
So I did want to read Morrison's comment on this series in particular really quickly. He said, I think All-Star is already complete without sequels. You read that last issue and it works because you know you're never going to see All-Star Superman again. You'll be able to pick up Superman books, but they won't be about this guy and they won't feel the same. He's really going away. Our Superman is actually dying in that sense, and that adds a whole deeper poignancy. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that... obviously, he has some leftover ideas. And it's always fun to talk about, like, if I got to revisit one of the most popular characters on Earth, what would I do? But I do like the finality of this series a lot. So in that sense, I think the sequel, the quote-unquote sequel, is to default to that idea of the tulpa again real quick. Telling stories about people that are larger than life, that are larger than themselves, and ideas that are larger than themselves, whether or not that be, I don't know, Green Lantern arresting God. I don't want to see All-Star Superman again. Does that make sense? Like, I feel like that would
stay away.
Cheapen it. By way of insulting something else, I don't feel great about but this book is the distillation of Superman as an idea. And while Morrison is saying, like, this is the death of our character, I kind of reject that and think that this could be the perfect end to any Superman story, as compared mm-hmm. to, like, Last Night on Earth, which is very definitely just the death of Snyder and Capullo's Batman.
Right.
And doesn't feel as essential or timeless as this story does. What about you?
Well, years earlier, before this came out, DC 1 Million came out. And in that series, which was an anthology series with Mark Waid and Mark Millar and Grant Morrison all writing stories. There is a scene.
It's like 8 where years. It was published like 8 years prior to this series.
Was it? There's a scene where Green Lantern collects these serums or something from a specific place, which is in this series. Basically, you remember when Superman has the vials of his DNA and Lois' DNA?
Yeah.
So I think Morrison was referring to that series as the future of this series.
It is meant to be, and the Superman squad is that.
Then you also have Golden Superman show up, right?
We could get into that. Yeah.
Is that Superman in the future, like in after he's finished recharging our sun or whatever he's doing?
Reader.
In there.
Yes.
I agree. I don't think it needs a sequel necessarily, especially after Morrison's take on Action Comics a couple years later when New 52 rebooted the series. I mean, it's kind of fascinating to compare the two, which I did this morning, because All-Star Superman is all about like hope and like the everyman, and then Action Comics is almost an inversion of it. And you've got this younger Superman who almost wants to reject being like the answer to humanity's problems or a symbol for them. And while I admit the series was probably rushed and Morrison probably wasn't able to do like a perfect story like he was here, where he got extra time to put out 3 issues. 3 years to do 12 issues. With Action Comics, the way it turned out, I almost wonder if Morrison has already said everything he needs to say about the character, because it almost seemed like with Action Comics he was forcing new ideas into this concept of the Superman. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if he'd be able to pull off All-Star Superman 2.
Yeah, I don't think he needs to, for sure.
Yeah. Right. But yeah, I do want to see him go back to Marvel, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean, if we're talking about Dream Morrison projects,
what do you got?
I would love to see him deconstruct the spider totems. Like, give him the Spider-Verse. Make it some sort of, like, looking at the web and life of Destiny as, like, some sort of eldritch abomination that drives people insane. Because he totally would do that. And then, of course, the right people see it as this opportunity to capitalize on being good and wholesome and stuff. Because he very much believes in the goodness of superheroes. Whether or not he contrasts that is up for debate, of course.
I wonder if he'll just stick with DC. I mean, he's obviously doing Green Lantern still. I wonder if he is even interested in doing a Marvel story ever again.
I don't see him doing anything more than 6 issues. For Morrison, often that's all you need. But I think he kind of told the quintessential Marvel story that he wanted to tell with new X-Men.
I don't know why my mind keeps going to Captain Marvel, but she's basically Green Lantern.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Or I guess Nova would be Green Lantern. It's a series you definitely need to read. All-Star Superman is one of the best series about superheroes ever written in the comic format, I'd say.
I will say that I enjoy reading Red Sun more, just because it's so silly and so dumb. And good. It's well-written, for sure. It's just a ridiculous idea. But if I were to direct anyone to, like, all right, you've read a little Justice League, or you've read a little Superman, read this.
He's already done Batman, so he's kind of, like, run out of characters.
Yeah, he did Wonder Woman.
Give him Superman. I mean, Spider-Man.
Give him Spidey. I want Spidey.
I mean, the character could use a revamp right now.
Yeah.
Just saying. Yeah. How about She-Hulk? No, that's
I think he needs someone that can be metaphysical in some way.
Yes, like a god. Yeah. Sentry! He could fix
that
Sentry.
Would be fun.
Okay, moving on to our last segment, Off Topic Top Shelf. I'm going to tell you something that's not comics related that I've been into lately, which is easy to do because we have so much more time inside. There's a new show on Amazon called Tales from the Loop that I started watching. And I was hooked on the first episode. I haven't dug too deeply yet. I'm just still finishing like shows like Devs, so which I actually mentioned on the show like 6 weeks ago, right? But I love these thought-provoking shows that have a touch of sci-fi in them, but a lot of realism. And it just kind of makes you think the world is magical, and it can be. And I think that's something we really could use a lot of right now. Just this idea that, you know, this physical place that we're in, there are great wonders that we haven't yet discovered. And that the show kind of embodies that. And it's a fun journey in that first episode. And there's a really cool sci-fi concept that comes to a head at the end that you're like, whoa, what would I do if I was in this situation? So yeah, I can't wait to finish the show. And I know you've been watching.
Yes.
It, right?
I'm a huge fan of what it's based on, which is the paintings and art collections of a Swedish artist named Simon Stålenhag, who has actually, he did a previous art book called Things from the Flood, and then another one called Tales from the Loop, which is what the show is based on. His paintings have stories to them, but he's never actually writing fiction or whatever about them, right? There's a tabletop role-playing game that is also very cool. I think it's from Mophius Entertainment. It's very neat, and it's a different adaptation than the show and Simon's books on the loop idea. I have been really, really impressed by the visual and audio design. And I've also been really impressed by how well they've extended the universe and the aesthetics of the universe beyond what is in Simon's paintings.
Yeah, there's something that's so alluring about the show, and I haven't seen his paintings, so I can't say for the paintings, but this melding of, like, I don't know, 50s style architecture and clothing, but with these crazy sci-fi ideas that you would only see in common media, like in the super future. Is that going on in the paintings?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's all about that dichotomy for sure.
Interesting. Yeah. I love that mix. Well, that's the end of the show. Thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please like, subscribe, and hand us a review on Apple iTunes. You know what? I don't think Frank gave us that review. He said he was going to give us last week.
Unforgivable.
Unforgivable. Tune in next week. We will be doing more book clubs. We'll be recapping the news. And, wait a minute. Mark Russell's going to be.
Oh, hey now. You're an all-star.
You're an all-star.
Mark Russell.
Get your game on. He'll be talking about recent series. Obviously, his Marvel debut was supposed to be this week. Curious to get his thoughts on the industry, especially from a guy like him who's worked with Ahoy, DC Comics quite a bit last year, and now he's moving into the Marvel realm. I'd love to know his thoughts, since he has touched so many things, and I'm sure he's connected with a lot of folks who are in the industry,
too.
Check it out.
Bye, y'all.